Hello and welcome. Today we're going to be discussing how to transform undergraduate biology education in the United States. I'm Jeff Mervis of Science Magazine. Joining me are four scientists, educators, and policymakers who have spent the past few days here in Washington at a conference sponsored by the National Science Foundation and AAAS, which publishes science. Its goal is to mobilize the community for change. Before we begin, let me introduce them. Starting on my far right, they are Jim Collins, head of the biology director at the National Science Foundation. In 2006, his office teamed up with NSF's education directorate to launch a series of regional meetings on the topic. It culminated in this week's national conference. And this fall, Jim will be returning to Arizona State. Next to him is Carol Brewer, professor of biology and associate dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Montana. Carol is co-chair of the advisory board for this week's meeting. Next to her is Peter Bruns, vice president of grants and special programs at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, which has also supported this effort. Peter's a former professor of genetics at Cornell. And Felicia Kiesing, an associate professor of biology at Bard College. In 2000, she received the Presidential Early Career Award for scientists and engineers from President Clinton. Welcome you all, and thanks for coming here.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
Good. This isn't the first time life sciences community has tried to improve undergraduate education in the United States, but the results of previous initiatives, to put it kindly, have been mixed at best. Before we explore why it's been such a tough nut to crack, I'd like to start with a simple question. The U.S. system of higher education is, by all accounts, the best in the world, and the productivity of our academic research enterprise is unmatched. So what's the problem, and what do you hope these reforms will accomplish? Take it in any order, or go back and forth, whatever you like.
I'd be less inclined to characterize it as a problem than as a challenge. So it's clear that the science is changing right in front of our eyes. And as a result of that, the community needs to really step up in terms of how we want to be instructing our young people relative to the biology that's in front of us now in terms of the 21st century. Yeah. The biological sciences themselves are not only changing, but the other sciences are changing around biology, and biology is being integrated into all those other sciences. And as a result, then, we really are faced with this very fascinating challenge about how do we move forward in that sort of really very complex environment at this particular time.
Okay. I would characterize some of what's happened is that we know more now. We know more in science. Our information systems are different, better, faster, much more accessible. We know that the science of teaching and learning has been moving forward, but now we in the science, research science community are beginning to hear about it and learn about it and learn from it. And the students that we have to teach are changing. So there's been a big change. And part of it is that we know more, and so it's time to do more with what we know more.
And I think it's also true that if you think about what you said the research universities and our productivity are the best in the world, but the people who populate the halls, the faculty members at those universities are the ones who thrived in the current system. That doesn't mean that the current system is working for all the other people who didn't stay in the academic environment. A lot of those people leave academia with leave their experience as college or university students without necessarily having learned the things that we want them to learn. And that's a lot of what we spent our time talking about. How do we get the people who don't become professional scientists to become capable thinkers about science?
Do you think that there is a big disconnect between what the professional community thinks and what the general public thinks? For example, in the course of covering hearings and meetings, I've heard countless politicians talk about how they almost flunked an introductory science course or biology course. They seem to be almost proud of that fact. Why do public officials, and by extension the public, think that confessing their ignorance about science is somehow okay? And doesn't that send a message that you can do poorly in STEM fields and still be a success in life?
Well, maybe it does, but you can also do poorly in humanities fields or in business fields and be a success, and that isn't the conversation that we hear as part of this discussion. I think the interesting thing that I hear, or that strikes me when I hear those comments, is, oh, rats, you know, I teach classes, or I taught classes of 450 students. Some of the classes I taught at the university, actually the rooms held more than the populations of many of the towns the students came from. They saw more people in that room than they'd ever seen in one place in their life. And I think, oh man, I sure hope that person wasn't in my intro bio course, because I didn't get to know them. And I didn't get to have the conversation with them that I would have liked to have had with them, so that they wouldn't have felt disenfranchised and used that common phrase we hear, oh geez, yeah, I flunked intro bio. Oh, I flunked it too. You know, they're part of this club that we created. And I think one of the exciting things about the conversations we've been having in the last 2 days is that we don't want that to be a popular club anymore. We don't want it to be a populated club. We really want to take the challenge of both training the major and the non-major seriously and do a better job for both audiences.
Yeah, I would say that a change that we are seeing, that we are trying very hard to effect, is to get the science research community recognizing issues of both preparing the future generations of scientists, but also science literacy for the public at all. We certainly heard from Bruce Alberts at this meeting some very interesting facts, concepts, and issues related to that. The idea, and I thought he put it so well, that the general public very much seems to think that science is revealed truth, just as religion is revealed truth, and that there's no difference between the two. And that very much already summarizes the challenge, I think, for the science community. But from where I'm coming from the really world of research science at Howard Hughes and major research universities, the active science community is beginning to look and recognize that it's their responsibility of it too.
And I think that goes to the value that we have at NSF, which is the integration between research and education. And it is really this challenge that's in front of us to, as Carol put it so well, we really want people to come to the courses and go away excited by the information and really feel that they need to understand it at some basic level, especially when we see the recent results of the Pew report.
Now, speaking of the challenge, the president has said he wants the U.S. to lead the world in college participation rates by 2020. Do you have a similar quantitative goal for improving undergraduate biology? And in any event, how do you hope to measure what you have achieved?
Well, that was exactly what we were talking about at the moment we left our last conversation. And if you call me about 5 seconds, I won't be able to tell you. Well, and that's exactly what we're struggling with. We had great examples of how major societal changes have happened over relatively short time frames. Big issues in our society. One example that came up over and over was how quickly, really, smoking became unpopular. That was a very quick change, a major change in our society. So, you know, what will it take? Felicia talked about leverage points. Where can we put, where do we have leverage to accelerate the transformations we're interested in? And that's what we struggled with over the last 2 days, and that's now what we need to go back and think about, but for a short time, because we really need to get to work.
I think we also came to realize over the conference that there are so many different kinds of change that we're talking about. We're talking about faculty members changing their attitudes and adopting different practices, for example, in their individual classrooms that require no one to change but themselves. Now, that's a change that you can affect over a very, very short time scale. We're also talking perhaps about departmental changes where they change their curricular structure and revamp their introductory courses. And there were lots of successful models from the conference of places that have done that, where they outlined what the process that they went through and what the outcomes were of that. Well, that might take a year, or maybe 2 years, to put into place. But then we're also talking about major infrastructural changes, about changing the value of science education as perceived by the broader community, so that faculty members who are interested in science education can devote a significant amount of time to that and feel that that's rewarded and incentivized by that community, by the broader community. That's a longer term change. So I think we're very aware of the scaling of those changes. We want people to, we actually were giving each other assignments for what to do on Monday to the conference as a whole. What can people do on Monday? That's about as short as it gets. But we also realize that when we're talking about, for example, when could we look back and say, you know what, all the things that we put forward as our major agenda items happened? Well, we were arguing about whether that's 10 years or 15 years. We realize that for everything to happen is a longer time frame, but that doesn't mean that a lot couldn't happen very, very quickly.
Well, but apart from the time, I mean, since you're involving so many different kinds of communities, I would think that having some kind of rallying cry would help unify.
So here's one aspect of it, and that we actually didn't dwell too much on at this meeting, but the constituencies that were there I know have, and that is understanding the nature of the professoriate and the professional science community, which is certainly another group they were talking about, and the need for diversity in that group because of all the benefits that you get from diversity. And I'm not just talking about job equity, I'm talking about the change in the nature of the workforce, which has a benefit to the product, which is the diversity that you get. If you look at the number of underrepresented minorities to white non-Hispanics, that ratio, as undergraduates as a total, it's about 4 to 10. Graduating with degrees in science, it's about 2 to 10. Currently graduating with PhDs in science, it's about 1 to 10. So it goes 4 to 2 to 1. Those are very simple, straightforward numbers. And if we think we need more people who are of underrepresented minorities in order to increase the diversity, there's a target.
So is the target to get back to 4?
Well, to get
that ratio?
To start increasing at the very least. It has not changed in the last several decades. And so we can try to increase there. Now, if that's the target, one has to make sure you understand what we're doing. We're not talking about tokens or anything like that. We're saying there are real people of value, of high potential, who we need to try to recruit, train, and get involved in this aspect of life. And so there's a target that we don't get.
Another way to answer the question is the community is telling us they're ready to think about new ways of teaching. And indeed, part of my first argument was that we really do need to move in that direction, given all the challenges that are in front of us. That in and of itself, though, raises a whole series of questions and even resurgent questions that have to do with what would competency-based outcomes look like? What would inquiry-based outcomes look like? What would concept-based outcomes look like? All that would be part of assessment. So we're really right at the point where we need to develop those kinds of metrics to begin to assess these new ways of teaching that we're encouraging faculty members to begin to start to do.
I have another way to look into this too. I work a lot with graduate students, and we're getting pressured from the students who we're training. I think I started teaching at the University of Montana about 17 or 18 years ago. But at that time, a lot of the grad students I worked with had a pretty singular focus aiming toward a university research type of position themselves, maybe. But the students, the grad students are really, I think they're telling us that they've seen what it's like to be me, and maybe they don't want to be like me when they have, when they start crafting their professional life. They want to have a professional life that explores what it's like to be a really good and effective teacher. They're coming to us with experiences from NSF GK-12 grants. They're coming to us with experiences, undergraduate research students in some of the kinds of programs that HHMI funds. Maybe they've spent time in Africa working on Felicia's projects. I mean, these are different students who have a different idea of what they want to do with their lives. And they're telling us, you better teach me how to teach, and you better teach me how to communicate, because I have lots of choices of where I could go to grad school. And I think they're putting a lot of pressure on us to rethink the training of the future professor. And they're helping us learn how to do a better job in the classroom. I think that's a really important pressure point, and it speaks really well to the future of academia, because soon they'll be us.
And I think if you want to talk about it, maybe, sorry to interrupt, but we had a group of undergraduates who attended the conference, and I think if you want to talk about immediacy and the pressure for change, it comes most eloquently from them, and it's unfortunate that they're not here. Bianca there just graduated from college from the other side of the camera, and I'm sure could talk to us about these things too. The undergraduates at the conference were basically asking us to do the very things that we all, you know, pontificate about. They're basically saying, well, make it harder for us, challenge us, give us applications, let us make our own mistakes, let us figure it out ourselves, don't tell us everything. And, you know, to stand there looking at, you know, 19-year-olds that sits at your conference who are looking at you saying, you know, that's right, we want that, and we want more of it, and it's not working well enough for us.
Well, and
makes
don't
it
forget,
very,
they
very
said,
tangible.
We want you to be enthusiastic
right.
about being
right.
in front of us in the courses right. that you're
They're
teaching.
Very clear about what they
yeah.
want and very
Well, that raises an interesting point, and I think we've already sort of touched on it in a few minutes so far, which is, it seems to me you are dealing with multiple audiences of undergraduates, and I think that point came out at the conference. Yes, you're dealing with people who want to become you, the future professors, but you're also dealing with the 28-year-old single moms who are at a community college getting technical training and are taking this course because they have to. They don't have any real interest in it or any commitment to the field. Does that suggest that you really have to have different strategies, or is part of what you're trying to say is, no, we have to do the same thing for all of those people if we want to have a high-quality education?
That's part of the change that I was saying before. The students are changing, and that, of course, we have to go with that. But by the way, I would correct what you said. I don't think those undergraduates who were there necessarily want to be our clones. In fact, I think one of the challenges they were throwing at us was, show us all the opportunities, like just show us you. And that's a really critical change. And that used to be, people used to say education, higher education was one of the few businesses where the customer wanted less. And I don't think that's the case anymore.
Yeah, that's very true.
So.
You know, your question is a really good one, and it was something we spent a lot of time at the conference talking about. How do you, which approaches work in which kinds of settings? And we had these intensive working groups where teams of maybe 6 to 8 people were sitting around a table, and the people might be, one might be from a large R1 research institution, another might be from a tribal college, and another from a community college. And so we really got a feel during the conference for what kinds of constituencies they were dealing with. You know, what I think became clear to me, at least participating in these discussions, is that learning theory doesn't change based on where you are. The implementation of learning theory might change. But a lot of the things that we were talking about, small group work, giving people unstructured problems and letting them sort through them on their own, all those kinds of things can be done in basically any classroom setting. The places where the implementation changes are actually relatively minor. It's, for example, if you're doing research labs and you're working with a non-traditional student population, like 70% of community college students are, if you're dealing with those, then expecting them to be in at night or on the weekends to collect data may not be reasonable. So you have to come up with labs that they can do that don't require them to be there outside of class time hours. So relatively simple structural changes, and I think we heard this quite clearly from our community college and other associates who work with non-traditional populations, that the basic approaches aren't any different. It's just the specific implementation.
Well, and you know, the irony of your question to me, which I found in my own practice as a new professor, is that we have this certain idea in mind of how we should teach majors. And typically that's the way we were taught. And we have to remember, we sort of survived a lot of, we survived a lot of teaching in a particular way. And where we had this fabulous opportunity to explore is in teaching the non-majors, the people that weren't going to become us, and maybe we weren't so worried about lecturing them to death. And I was trying to avoid like crazy saying that, but sometimes that's the attitude of faculty, unfortunately. But what we found and what the evidence shows now, I mean, we have evidence that says that the kinds of teaching strategies Felicia was talking about and the kinds that we spent a lot of time talking about at this meeting work. They work. They work for people who have no intention of being scientists as a career. And thank goodness they do, because now they're going to be able to use that way of knowing to understand the complex issues that they're reading about in the newspaper. That's a success. But why on earth would we want to keep punishing our majors with teaching methods that we have data that show don't work that well? Why would we do that? And I think that becomes a pressure point, a leverage point for us to work
with. So why have you had that persisted for decades?
Well, one reason I think that this conference shows can change the other way is that in science research, we create a community. So in your discipline, you have your society, you have your journals, you have your meetings, you have your grant proposals that are read by your peers. There's a real horizontal exchange of information and ideas. We hadn't, I think, until just really this is a change, recognized the need to create teaching learning communities that also do that. And so these are perfect examples. At this meeting, it was clear, in my working group anyway, that those of us from Research One universities heard some techniques and approaches from people from community colleges that we hadn't even thought of, let alone used, that work that would apply as well. So the kind of intellectual exchange that occurs in the scientific research community is now slowly beginning to happen in the, I think, the education community. As, for example, Science Magazine doing the Science Education Forum. Here is a place where when asked why put something like that in Science Magazine, the answer is, well, that's where the scientists are, dummy. I mean, and so having even publishable papers in places where the science research community can access it is a change, and is beginning to create that kind of community as well.
So you have these diverse audiences, to get back to your question. But if I remember, the other part of your question was, what do we want to be learning? And that's the other part of the conversation that happened. What are the basic concepts? What are the basic theoretical issues that, regardless of where the students are at in their developmental stage, you also want to agree as a community that here are the basic ideas that we want everyone to be able to understand. But we're going to have to deliver it in different kinds of ways. I think that's what we're hearing here.
Well, let's stay on that, about what they want to learn. So I think one of the speakers, you know, talked about every faculty member being his or her own curriculum director. To the extent, you know, that in K-12, you have a movement to try to come up with unified standards, and that is difficult. Leaving aside the disincentives at the university level to do this to begin with, do you think we need some sort of national standards movement for undergraduate biology akin to the standards movement at the K-12 level? Because otherwise you're going to have tens of thousands of curriculum specialists devising their own courses.
Wait, may I take that on? Because we've just undertaken that.
That's a great question.
In a study that HHMI sponsored with the Association of American Medical Colleges. And that study was started because of the argument that many bio majors are pre-meds, and therefore pre-med needs to drive what's delivered in the bio major. And many biologists have said what the medical schools are requiring don't really reflect modern biology and don't reflect even what we think that medical students maybe would need to know. So we formed a working committee made up of educators and scientists from medicine and from the undergraduate world, and they worked for 2 years. They just released a report, a commercial message. There was an editorial in Science Magazine about it, and it said that don't do a list of courses, do a list of concepts and competencies, both for the graduating, what you need to graduate from medical school, but also what you need to enter medical school. And it is that same kind of thinking that ended up being developed in completely in parallel at this meeting as well, where this, the science, the undergraduate science community is saying, talk about concepts and competencies before you talk about specific little courses and things like that.
How is the buy-in going to happen?
But before we take that,
okay, sorry.
There's another aspect of this that I think our community is just starting to wake up to. When I took intro biology, I actually started college as an art major, but I remember my intro bio textbook very well. It was about an inch thick. The book I started using when I started teaching at the University of Montana many years later was about 4 inches thick. And the course length actually was the very same as the one that I took as an intro bio student. There is so much information available today compared to when I was a student, which wasn't that long ago. Compared to 10 years ago, there is such a proliferation of information. How can we ever be so crazy to think that we could cover all of it? And this discussion about picking which facts are the winners and rise up to the top, especially for entry students, may be a sort of a distracting question to be asking ourselves, because everybody wants their thing to be at the top of the list. So why not let them have that at the top of their list, but instead start out by thinking, what do we want our students to be able to do? And part of that means we have to trust them to go home in the evenings or on weekends and to engage themselves with interesting material and learn something about it. I think one of our interesting conversations at this meeting was the conversation about how do we get our students to really know and embrace and experience a scientific way of learning about something. Because frankly, if we do that, then they can learn anything they want to, and they'll need to use that skill every single day of their lives, whether they're biology majors or not. Now, that said, we know just from consensus in our societies and our communities what things are important, what the foundation was to learn, make those new discoveries. That's well known, and that's an easy jumping off to place, I think. It's so easy to just get distracted by what should be in the book or on the test.
One of our working groups really tackled this question of what should the standards be, and with a group of 60 people all working together, what could those 60 people from tremendously diverse institutions and professional backgrounds as biologists come to agreement about the fundamental concepts and competencies? Now, the first thing I think is interesting about that, and this echoes what others have said, is that they didn't just say what concepts, and that's a change that I've seen really happen just in the last couple of years, that concepts and competencies, what should they know and what should they be able to do, essentially, have become parallel concepts. And the lists were about equally long when they came out of that group, which is another interesting thing. Also, what's interesting is that the level at which they were able to agree on concepts was very high. In other words, you can get agreement that these are the major ideas in biology, like evolution, structure and function, systems, function of systems. But though at that level, we can get agreement that students who go through a biology curriculum should come out with certain level of sophistication of awareness about those things and about competencies, parallel, how to think critically, how to communicate, how to think about the relationships between science and society and things like that. So I think if 60 people at this conference who are passionate about education can come to agreement about what those things are, I think it's fair to say that just about anybody can. In terms of implementation, we also heard some wonderful examples of how people have gotten consensus by working within departments. So Bill Wood at the University of Colorado at Boulder talked about an initiative that they've been running there for the past few years where departments compete to be a part of a program called the Science Education Initiative. And people in that program, if the department gets picked through this competitive process, then they get a bunch of resources to rethink their curriculum. And one of those things is that some time and some expert help to think about what their course structure is going to be like for their introductory courses. And they come up with concepts and competencies that need to infuse these first-year courses. But what I found interesting and really relevant to this discussion about that is that they only expect that to cover about 60% of the course. In other words, the agreed-upon stuff covers a chunk of the course, right? And it's not a huge detail. It's just these are the things we expect you to cover in 60%, but 40% is the instructor's discretion. That's at the level of the department. We would expect that those percentages to maybe go down as you get further away from the department, but we'd still be left with something like 30 or 40%, say, of what we're teaching across introductory biology to be similar. I think that would be a fair benchmark for us.
I think that's right. You wind up with pressures from within the community to come up with these sets of basic concepts and ideas. That'll eventually be mapped onto textbooks in a way that they are not quite mapped onto textbooks right now. Then you begin to get that as a reinforcing part. We're also hearing about external pressures, for example, from industry that wants certain kinds of competencies, and larger societal challenges, whether it's global climate change or energy issues. Collectively, we heard, begin to put pressures on what you're teaching in a way that you come up with a set of concepts, competencies, inquiry-based understanding, the kind of scholar that you want at the end of the process who can go out into the workforce with a certain set of skills that will be evolvable. Going to be changing rapidly over the work lifetime of these individuals, and we're going to have to be able to produce more of those sorts of individuals as we go ahead.
Okay, I want to follow up on what Felicia just said about scaling up, and the Science Education Initiative, I think, is a good example. That's a multi-million dollar effort led by a Nobel laureate who has staked his reputation on it.
And it's money.
But at best, it's at two universities and a handful of departments. Even if it's successful, and NSF is supporting hundreds of other, you know, programs through, you know, CCLI and other programs, those are at individual institutions.
So I'll respond to that.
Why is it so hard to go national or even regional or even statewide with those kind of programs?
So first of all,
education.
That program's an experiment. It's only in its third year, and it already has two institutions. So,
and you should have seen
ways,
the looks on people's faces.
In some ways, we shouldn't say it's not. It is just going. I think what you need to do is to ask what are the ingredients in that program, and what can we learn from that? And then, do we have to clone it, or can we take elements from that and use them elsewhere? So what are the ingredients? So first, it's department-based. That's a very critical point that they make. It required the department as a whole to compete for this, which meant they had to get the faculty together. And they didn't get quite all the faculty, I think, initially, but they got enough to write a competitive proposal so that they would do it. So they walked into the activity with already the base of not just one lone ranger, but a group of the faculty, although there clearly is a leader here and there. I mean, that's life. But once you address it that way, you start talking about the fundamental unit of the curriculum, and a lot of other things too, by the way, like hiring and tenure decisions and all that. But anyway, the curriculum. So indeed, they worked on their intro course, but they're working on the entire curriculum that that department offers. And so what do they get from this? Well, the main thing they get are these teaching fellows, that are postdoctoral fellows who come in to do some science as well, but who then do want to be involved in better teaching. They themselves take some courses and have a seminar where they really attend to the science of teaching and learning and what they can learn from that.
In partnership with the faculty
member. Well, no, but I mean, no, they themselves as a group do that. So
oh,
they have a seminar and all that. So that they have that group thing doing its thing. And then they themselves, so that's from all the separate departments. They come together and talk about issues like that. But then the fellows who are in a specific department then get connected with specific faculty members for a period of time, not to teach their course, but to work with that faculty member to bring in new ideas. So they're not replacing the faculty. They're there to help the faculty, and the faculty in turn help them. So that is a very different way of approaching it at the department level. So we at Howard Hughes are certainly watching that model very carefully. We're letting them run the experiment. That's great. But that doesn't mean that there isn't an opportunity for the whole program, the whole gold-plated program on the one hand, or aspects of it on the other to really have a major impact.
But again, I really want to press this, going back over the history of what NSF has supported or Hughes, can anybody think of a single example that has gone large scale? Yes, this is only in its third year, and people think that it's great.
Or a movement? Or
I mean specific approach that is different, that is quantifiably better, and that succeeds in achieving the goals that you set out to achieve.
Well, the 20
not just attitudinally or philosophically.
Well, in the 20 years of Hughes undergraduate, institutional undergraduate grants, the single component that's been there all along, that's been the single largest component, has been supportive undergraduate research. I would say in that 20 years, it has gotten the concept and support of undergraduates doing research has grown substantially. It's grown in the original way it started, that is typically rising seniors spending a summer doing research, to academic year opportunities, to those opportunities actually getting academic credits so that they become part of the curriculum, and now to whole classes doing research, and now to research being done by entering freshmen.
Right.
That's the exact example I would have picked.
Undergraduate research is a great example. I think you can look to the conviction that you cannot just stand in front of a class of 400 students and lecture for 40 or 45 minutes or 50 minutes. The use of clickers, for example, to engage students on an ongoing basis in the conversation that you're having with them is another technique to begin to break down that distance between the lecturer and the audience out there in a way that engages them in the conversation throughout the 40 to 45 minutes and gives them immediate feedback in terms of their understanding of the material that you're discussing.
Well, you know, the other aspect of this that I think clearly is an evidence-based conclusion, and that is that finding ways to build community in your classroom between students, among students, pays off in how they learn the material, how well they learn the material, and how much they stay engaged with the material. And interestingly, I think there's evidence emerging that getting faculty together as members of communities to talk about how they teach, how well they teach, and to help each other problem solve and stay engaged with the conversation of how to teach is a major change that's happened because both of those have happened because of lots of little different unreplicated experiments all over the country. And those are enduring, and they were not the norm when I started teaching. That's for darn sure.
You know, 8 years ago, when I wrote my first education-based proposal, I looked around for evidence, some kind of evidence that certain kinds of interventions in the classroom or outside of the classroom worked. There was virtually no evidence, and I think you could all concur with this. There was virtually no evidence. There were people doing experiments, but that was just 8 years ago, maybe nine. At the conference, we had a poster session, a couple hundred posters, right? It's trying to be a couple hundred posters. And virtually every single one of them presented evidence that of a pre versus a post test comparison or a control group versus another. There's just burgeoning evidence all over the place that certain kinds of interventions work. And as people see that evidence, I think it gets easier for those ideas to be adopted. So my point is, in response to your question, I think one of the reasons that we haven't gone national as quickly is because we simply didn't have the evidence. We're scientists, right? So we look very closely at evidence, and I think scientists have felt like this was this sort of loosey-goosey education world, perhaps, that couldn't bring us the numbers. But we can bring the numbers now about you tell us what numbers matter to you, and we can give you an example of where student-centered learning or hands-on research or something like that, one of these crazy interventions, actually substantially increases students' interest in science or their understanding of concepts or their enthusiasm for the subject matter. We have evidence for all of that from these different kinds of interventions.
I want to have you talk a little bit about resources. More resources may not be sufficient to achieve change, but surely they're important, if not essential. How do you think the current recession, given the pressures on universities and institutions, is going to affect the ability individuals to have the kind of impact on their institutions that you're hoping will happen, that this group is supposed to go back and make a difference with?
Well, I think there are a lot of things that can be done with no resources. speaking as someone who now lives in an administrative office on my campus.
Could you list those for us, Karen?
Let me count the ways. Seriously, one of the biggest things that has to change is just your attitude. You can go into a classroom tomorrow with no more resources than you had yesterday and ask your students for 5 minutes to discuss an idea and then let them tell you something about what they were discussing. That costs nothing except probably 5 PowerPoint slides out of your lecture. That's the cost. That's a zero cost. So there are things that we can do, and as administrators, we can help our colleagues have the flexibility to experiment with in their classes. That costs us nothing. There are things that we would like to do to help our faculty learn more about these kinds of innovations that do cost money, and one of those is coming together in groups like the one that we've met in for the last several days that do cost a little bit of money, and those can be absolutely transformative in terms of getting people mobilized, and fortunately, even in these hard times, we've had funding to make this sort of event happen. I think we can do a lot in this time of recession. We may not get the new instrumentation we want to support our classes with, the absolute cutting art kinds of tools, but we can still do a lot with what we have, and the recession won't last forever.
One of the things that came out of the conferences, and this was largely due to Peter and his group's efforts, was a compendium of all of the different resources that are available free on the web and in various other locations, but a lot of them on the web. There's just a tremendous amount of teaching and learning material available that's funded by NSF and all these other initiatives that you and others have mentioned. And I think what that speaks to is that there's a lot out there. And so if you don't need to get a CCLI grant from NSF, you don't need to get all this other funding in order to take the fruits of that funding and move it forward. There are a lot of these implementation strategies that are available from Howard Hughes' site, from NSF sites, that where you can take it off and just plug it into your classroom. We don't need to keep paying for each instantiation of this.
So, but we do need to find ways to make those resources more visible, and that was
an absolute clear
message to us.
So that's clear. When we fund things at NSF, we're typically looking for the very best models. And so we will not be in a position to sustain lots and lots of programs, but we can catalyze lots of change. So Felicia's right. We fund models, and we want to get them up in a way that they can then be put out to lots and lots of communities. But on the other hand, there's the old adage that, you know, a vision without resources is a mirage. And so at some point, you really do have to provide the resources. And I would point out that at some point, institutions will have to make value judgments. They really will have to sit back and decide, we have resources. It's a question of where you choose to put those resources. And the point that this community is beginning to make is, this is the sort of activity that really does deserve resources. Now we have to decide where they're going to come from.
Now, Jim, you reminded the conference about the slew of previous reports on the subject.
I did.
Do they offer any useful lessons on what to do or mistakes to avoid?
Well,
is 2009 different than these previous areas?
Well, I think what a number of them just continue to echo is this notion of learning as this creative process by which knowledge is discovered. Each one begins to, in one way or another, begin to converge on that, even in the most recent one that goes to competency-based talents. So at the core is that kind of thinking. It's getting away from the notion, which I think is a common one, going back to one of your original questions about failing biology or failing science, that science is this collection of facts that you memorize. It's a beaker that you fill with all of this information. It's this dynamic learning process, and these reports converge on that sort of way of thinking. And that's central to what's going on here, Jeff, in terms of moving that front and center as far as biology education is concerned.
I think even the process of creating some of these reports have been important and useful. As things change and new areas happen, how does it happen? They get nucleated by individual leaders, you know, the Lone Ranger, and then they start working alone, and then there's another one working alone, and another, and then as we start to have opportunities for them to come together, they realize I'm not alone. They also learn from each other and help each other. And as I say, it's kind of like building a crystal now, and the crystal then starts to form and grow. So even the process of bringing people together to create those reports and this report is it's slowly increasing the network of the choir. The choir is getting bigger, we're beginning to sing in harmony, and others can start to hear. And I think that just that process is useful. Secondly, I think the reports turn out to not only state things that should be stated, but state things in ways that people can build on, that can use those statements in those reports to then go beyond it, but as a good starting point, again, as a nucleating center. We were talking just before we came here about some other reports. And one thing that I hadn't really thought about before is that when you look at this whole range of reports, there is a diversity of targets to whom they are aimed. And that somewhat alters the nature of the report. And you just have to take that into account. So they aren't all exactly the same sort of thing and redundant and forget it. I mean, they have different target audiences.
Now, even if this effort succeeds, as Lucia said, it'll take a long time.
Even?
When?
Okay, excuse me. Right. And most people expect our system of higher education to look a lot different 20 years from now. How do you hit a moving target, especially one as complex as this?
To use the target analogy, but maybe with lots and lots of balls, lots and lots of people going out at that diffuse target and starting something on their own campus or in their own department. And the answer is going to be a little bit different in Montana than it is in New York and than it is in Arizona. That I think that's part of what makes this so interesting and so challenging.
Another way is you help people be there when the target gets there.
With money,
with ideas, and understanding what it is.
Part of the answer will also be that we really don't have the luxury in many ways of lots of time. That I think it was J.K. Haynes pointed out that there are these external pressures that are building up and coming to the academy that will begin to sharpen the conversation and sharpen people's ways of thinking, that it hasn't necessarily been sharpened in the last couple of decades. That will bring the community together, I think, ways that will cause them to look at how we can find the best ways to educate these students, and then they will look for best practices. They will look for these reports, and they will look for the things on the web, and that will get you a convergence of action much faster than waiting decades for this to occur.
Okay. Well, I want to thank everyone. I know you have to go back and continue your deliberations and efforts. So there's a lot more that can be said. And maybe as a final word, is there a place people can look to track what is going on and follow and possibly interact?
There certainly is. The conference website can be found linking off of AAA, the AAAS website. And we have dropped our toe into the social networking world as well. People can also look on Facebook for the Transforming Undergraduate Biology Education Group. And both of those places are sites where the work that we do will be posted, and people will be invited to join us in that work.
And there's a growing list of resources from the conference that's going on.
That will
be on that project website.
To get to the website, you just Google Vision and Change.
Google Vision and Change or Transforming Undergraduate Biology Education.
And should they also keep an eye on Hughes and NSF websites for funding opportunities or future
opportunities. I think
they
should.
Why wouldn't they?
Not only funding opportunities, but resources.
But by the way, we will keep a growing list of funding opportunities on the Vision and Change website as we learn about them. That's going to be a dynamic resource that we intend to build on.
So you can go through NSF, through use, or right through the website.
Or through Facebook.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Oh,
you've thrown out a lot of interesting questions, and I'm sure it won't be the last conversation.
No, thanks a lot.
Thanks
for having us, Jeff.
Thanks very much.
Oh, my God, you forgot to turn it on.